KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle's primary election's less than a month from now, and some of the mayoral candidates have started to roll out their ad campaigns. Big question, are voters paying any attention? It's Friday, the day we look back at the week's news, and in the studio with me, three people who do pay attention to this. Knute Berger is the Moss Back at Crosscut.com, editor-at-large for Seattle Magazine. C.R. Douglas is here. He's political analyst for Q13 Fox News, and editor Erica C. Barnett of Publicola is here. Nice to have you, too.
Thank you.
And Knute, it's always nice to have you as well. But I see you every week. Before we get mired in the Seattle mayoral campaign weeds, any thoughts about the reorg at Microsoft? Does that even touch your worlds? Erica said no right off.
I'm a Mac girl all the way.
Well, a little bit. I mean, Microsoft touches this region, of course, and if this reorg helps them kind of reboot their company, then I suppose we all benefit. You know, they have tried reorgs before, and this is their latest version of it. Part of the problem has been, of course, that this is a company that is still a bit stuck in a PC world, and it's quickly sort of passing them by. They're sort of late to tablets. They're late to mobile. This is an attempt by Ballmer to kind of get back into that game. It goes from a more autonomous structure to a more centralized structure, fewer people reporting to him, all the rest. And he seems to think that's going to help them be more agile going forward.
Knute, any thoughts?
Well, Microsoft used to do a reorg every, 6 months or something. I mean, for years, I mean, they had, different campuses, different buildings. And every time you went out there, the people that you talked to before were in a different building and a different,
different job.
And everything. And that was actually, there was part of the culture. But I think one of the things that they faced over the years is this dilemma of both, well, the advantages of being too big and the disadvantages of being too big. And I remember years ago when the antitrust stuff was happening, Fred Moody, who covered that for The Weekly and had written a book about Microsoft. And one of the things that he said that he thought that it was that the DOJ should have broken up Microsoft, that actually would have been to Microsoft's advantage. And his argument was that they didn't want to get in the sort of big lumbering colossus mode that if they were broken up into different divisions, that it would help them keep the kind of very innovative entrepreneurial mm-hmm. sort of thing. So it's interesting to see that that's coming back into the company. There was an article in the Seattle Times about that this week, as well as the reorg thing, which is sort of centralizing control, getting more streamlined management, but at the same time trying to let employees have a more of a innovative and entrepreneurial kind of approach. And so I think they're trying to, play the big card, but also the small card within that, so that they can be more nimble, I think, is one of the things, more responsive. The other thing I remember is how talking with somebody from Microsoft years ago, it's very difficult to dream up big businesses. In other words, when you're the size of Microsoft, an entrepreneurial effort can't be a small, make a few million here type of effort. It has to be scalable to something big. And that's, that's very difficult to do. This guy said it's very hard to think up a billion-dollar business. Mm. So I think one of the challenges there is, how do they become more innovative, but at a big level, unlike a small gaming company in Pioneer Square.
Well, it's interesting, as you're talking, I'm thinking about Boeing, which I know that the governor is trying to keep Boeing here at all costs to get the 787X assembly here. But I just heard this morning that Charleston, South Carolina, essentially cut to pretty much nothing, any kind of taxes Boeing would have to pay. These are two major employers with billion-dollar businesses. And, Ciara, as you pointed out, their health is very relevant to, to the Puget Sound region.
Absolutely. And I think Skip's right. It's tough to figure out that next billion-dollar business, but so many others have. I mean, look at the things Microsoft missed out on. They missed out on Google. This becomes this $100 billion business. They missed out on Facebook. They missed out on Twitter. They missed out on LinkedIn. They missed out on Skype. They eventually had to buy it for $8 billion. They missed out on iPads. They missed out on iTunes. It's not because there aren't smart people over there, but there is a culture, I think Skip's right, to sort of mammothness that makes it hard. But under Ballmer, there have been some successes. I mean, you've got the Xbox and Kinect, and that's done well. But there have been all kinds of things they missed.
In the meantime, in the last hour, Luke Timmerman from the journal Xconomy was here talking about all these biotech spinoffs that have come out of the University of Washington, out of the Hutch, and they are those small, little, nimble businesses that can make it, I think. So interesting to see what happens with that industry. We're talking over the week's news with a lot of political mavens, Erica C. Barnett of Publicola, C.R. Douglas, who you just heard, of Q13, and Knut Berger, the Mossback, and mayoral ads, some serious, some I'm not sure what, definitely tongue in cheek. Yeah, exactly. Who is watching ads? Because I've also seen some data that show that very few people are going to cast ballots.
Well, this is really interesting. I mean, I don't personally know a lot of people who actually watch TV as TV. I mean, people DVR, people stream Netflix, you know, and so all these ads are on cable. They're on MSNBC. I think the Home and Garden channel is one of them. The candidates are all making these ad buys of, you know, $25,000, $60,000. And, you know, I think in some ways, one candidate who has said he is not going to do ads because he can't afford it is Peter Steinbrück. He's going to focus on direct mail. And I think in a low turnout primary like we're going to have this time, they're saying, you know, it's going to be about 35% or so. That may be even optimistic. In a low turnout primary like this, that might actually be an effective strategy because I don't know who is seeing these ads. And frankly, the quality of the ads so far has been pretty low to pathetic. And so, you know, I don't know who is going to see an ad by Ed Murray saying, you know, I passed gay marriage and I'm a good Democrat and I like, you know, John F. Kennedy, and say, that's the guy I'm going to vote for.
As a person who comes from TV, and they aren't doing any of these on broadcast media, so they're not buying ads on Q13, at least not yet. These are all cable ads. It's a cheaper form. But I can tell you, more people will see these ads probably than them will vote. TV is still something people watch. Even if you DVR, you are seeing, you know, you tend to get the ads if you don't pass through them. But, you know, they don't buy these if they don't think they're gonna be watched. I think they have been fine. I don't think any of these particularly jump out at me. Although I will say of the ads so far, you have basically McGinn ads, you have Harrell ads, you have Charlie Stadiker ads, although those are only web-based, and you have Ed Murray ads. I think the best so far have been Harrell. I think they've been the most interesting, the most kind of jump out at you, and that's because Harrell, as a person, is the most compelling of the people who have ads up. He is more forceful as kind of a presence. He's more charismatic, and that comes through. Ed's ads are a little flat. Ed's a little bit flatter. He's a little bit wonkier. You know, the mayor can't even be in his ads.
By law?
No, it's just that he's so unpopular that they're not putting him in his ads. I think that's a deliberate choice. You have surrogates sort of talking about him. So these ads are sort of serving different purposes. But if someone said, how would you score them now? I would give Harrell the best ads.
Well, we've had this conversation for the past few weeks that of the, I'm using Knut's word, mushy, the mushy campaign that we've seen so far, that Harrell has been the candidate on the stump who's sort of been the least mushy.
Well, I wouldn't say least mushy, but I would say he comes across with, he does inspirational, motivational speaking, and it comes through in his presentations. And I've seen him perform really well in some of those forums in terms of how he comes across. I actually thought the McGinn ads were pretty good. because they keep the mayor out of the picture, have people talking on his behalf about his accomplishments. I think part of the purpose of these ads is from the major candidates is to get their names out there. I don't think advertising's not going to win. I mean, but it's going to help the people who have either aren't well known enough, or as in the case of the mayor, are trying to get people focused on the positive and not the negative. And I don't think they'll be decisive in the primary. I mean, I'd be surprised if they were. But
you guys, because you're a nonprofit at Crosscut, you don't take any kind of tile ads. But I see sometimes Seattle Met, where Publicola is housed, has sometimes ads floating around the sidelines somewhere. So will we see campaign ads on that?
I have no idea. I hope so. If anybody from the campaigns is listening right now, please call. I'm not on that side of it. We have in the past, for sure. Just to go back to McGinn's ads.
Okay, sure. So he has
two surrogates speaking for him. And personally, I mean, I am not quite yet in the demographic that will be voting in this primary. It's the Seattle Times said it would be 73%, I think, 45 and older. So it could be that having Estela Ortega from El Centro de la Raza and having Pat McCoy, a library advocate, an older woman kind of speaking on his behalf, will be effective with older voters. But to me, when I saw them, I just thought, well, okay, the Families and Education Levy passed with more than 60% of the vote, but it always does. The Library Levy passed with more than 60% of the vote, but it always does. And McGinn didn't do that. I mean, he promoted them, sure, and you can certainly take credit for that. That's a fair thing to claim. But I just always think it's odd to see candidates claiming credit for something that voters did and that voters always do, in this case, by overwhelming margins.
Go ahead.
I take a slightly different view. I think leading those big public levy or bond measures is an important accomplishment. I mean, those don't just happen. I mean, you have to sort of create the program. You have to sort of get your council on board to approve, you know, for instance, a library levy or a families and education levy. And by the way, they doubled the families and education levy, and McGinn pushed that. And then go out and lead the campaign and get it passed. I mean, they don't all pass, but they have a pretty good track record here in Seattle. And I think that's something to tout as an accomplishment. And certainly, and he hasn't done it yet, and perhaps there's going to be an ad coming out, the seawall. I mean, I think probably that's not one that was sort of a renewal. I mean, that sort of came out of nowhere, and you got to give McGinn credit for that. I mean, he was out of the gate with that seawall levy. He sort of pushed it. He got a reluctant council to finally go on board, and it was passed with something like 70% of the vote.
But if I was one of his competitors and I saw that seawall ad, which may very well be coming out, I mean, they've said that they might do similar ads in the future, I would point to the tunnel vote, which he lost by more than 60%, or by around 60%. So not a completely, perfect track record of accomplishment on votes.
Well, I think I was just going to say real quick, I just think having the older women speaking on your behalf about education and libraries is probably a very positive, targeted thing.
It's aimed at me, I think. We're talking over the week's news with Knute Berger, Erica Barnett, and C.R. Douglas, and we're going to continue our conversation about the election after this break here on Weekday on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the structural engineering firm of Swenson Say Faget, with offices in Seattle and Tacoma, working collaboratively with architects, contractors, and homeowners, as well as public and private sector clients, to create effective building solutions. More information at SwensonSayFaget.com.
59 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Forecast says it'll be partly sunny this afternoon, and we should bust up into the low 70s. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:21.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and it's Friday. That's the day we talk over the week's news with our panel of journalists today. They include Erica C. Barnett of Publicola, C.R. Douglas of Q13 Fox News, Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. We were talking about mayoral ads, and one of the questions I had is, as I understand it, the ballots are going to start arriving, or they should start arriving midweek next week. And you know, we hear about endorsements, we hear about how much people have spent on ads, but it doesn't feel like this race is cracking wide open at this point, or, unless I've missed something.
Cracking open in the sense of
here's the leaders, yay!
Well, the Seattle Times declared McGinn and Murray the leaders the other day. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I do think it is, I mean, it's such an unpredictable race, you know, the fact that it's that it is going to be a small turnout, and you know, an older voters certainly favors Peter Steinbrück as somebody that could, you know, be a surprise victor, at least in getting through the primary. And I think it's down to McGinn, Murray, and Steinbrück at this point.
And not Harrell, who you've just declared 10 minutes ago as the most dynamic candidate?
Well, I didn't declare him that, but I do agree with that. He is, but how many people go to these forums? It feels like it's, you know, the same 50 people plus 25 new ones at every forum. And so, you know, you're talking about this tiny, tiny part of the population that's actually seeing this really dynamic candidate and this really great speaker. And then everybody else is sort of, you know, I mean, doesn't know who he is or doesn't know a whole lot about him.
CRE wanted to.
I think it is becoming a three-person race between McGinn, Steinbrück, and Murray, as Erica says. I think Harrell, who's done well at these forums, you know, he's got a lot going for him in this campaign. But in polls, he really hasn't broken through sort of low to mid-teens, whereas the others are up in the sort of mid-20s, low to mid-20s. So he's 10 points behind, and unless something really changes, you know, I thought it was a good ad, but I think he would probably need more than that in the next month. So it's probably a three-person race right now, and I think McGinn is probably, you know, has the best shot of at least being one of the people through that primary, and I think you're now kind of talking about is it Murray, is it Steinbrück, who becomes that number two through.
Can't you agree?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom is leaning toward a McGinn-Murray race, partly because of the kinds of that McGinn is the incumbent with a small but very motivated base of supporters. And Murray is getting a lot of both kind of business and environmental endorsements. So, yeah, he's and you can sense that there's a sort of an establishment swing toward Murray. However, you know, I think Peter is got name familiarity in a sense. He doesn't have to do some of the TV advertising precisely because of that. He's known and experienced and. You know, a very good grassroots campaigner. So, you know, the other thing is that we all thought Nichols had it in the bag 4 years ago. At least he would make it through the primary. I think a lot of people were really surprised that he didn't. It's very possible McGinn won't make it through the primary if there's enough. If Murray gets enough momentum and Peter's name familiarity and message resonate, and so it'd be very interesting to see a Murray Steinbrück race.
Yeah, that's kind of the one I would like to watch the most.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned message. Are there particular? There's been a lot made of, you know, we're a Democratic city and all these people stand for this pretty much within the spectrum of the same progressive issues. So, are there issues that define these three frontrunners that would differentiate them as opposed to, like, I love the environment, I love transit, I love whatever?
Well, I think, you know, I think if you end up with the McGinn Steinbrück race, it's going to come down to, you know, issues of development, density, you know, Steinbrück, you know, has sort of mocked McGinn's proposal to build, you know, a potentially $750 million new bridge, light rail bridge to Ballard as a waste of money. So I think if that is the race, that's what it's going to come down to. Murray has really, I mean, and I think this is sort of his weakness. He's defined himself in terms of his record in the legislature to an extent that, you know, I think harms him because you're kind of like, well, why don't we send you back there? Because, you know, I mean, his ad is all about how he passed gay marriage and he passed the civil rights bill. And those are great accomplishments, but they're not local civic accomplishments. They're statewide accomplishments. And so I think he needs to define himself more in terms of city issues. And he hasn't really done that yet.
I was going to ask if in one-on-one conversations, any of the three of you have managed to tease out some particular civic issue that is at the top of his priority list.
Well, the Crosscut writers met with him yesterday, with Ed Murray yesterday, and the two things I think that he were at the top of his issue were the public safety and the DOJ, the transformation of the police department. He thinks that sort of no matter what, that is going to be the number one thing on the plate of the next mayor, particularly hiring a new chief, getting someone from some place that knows how to do the cultural transformation. So, and then very high up on the priority list is transportation. And I think his approach is to kind of translate what he claims that he was able to do in the legislature to Seattle in terms of his criticism of the transportation situation here is that we get into what he called mode wars. You know, so you get arguing over bus rapid transit versus rail and that kind of thing. And he thinks we need to take a much more sort of regional and strategic approach to what we do and a much more sort of let the numbers dictate what your solution is.
I just have to follow up on something. He wants to build on what he did. This is the legislature that did not pass a transportation package. They were unable to do that.
Well, he has an 18-year record as a legislator. That's what he's talking about. When you talk about the current, this past legislative session, you know, he's clearly not happy with
it. He did, when he was transportation chair down there in the House, they did the 9-cent gas tax, which is what he touts, the largest transportation package ever. So, right, this year the record hasn't been good, but he does have that in the past. I think with Murray, it is mostly a stylistic race. You know, he's going to take on some of this, you know, regionalism on transportation, but it's not about this huge directional shift Seattle has to make in, you know, being a progressive city. I mean, that's not where Murray's coming from. He's very much coming from, I can sort of work with people. I can get along. This guy, meaning McGinn, has a tendency to pick fights, whether that be with the tunnel, whether that be on DOJ, and those are two ones he brings up a lot. So he's banking on the fact that the perception of McGinn is bully that doesn't seem to get along, which kind of really doesn't sit well with Seattle voters, as opposed to big substantive, you know, changes in direction he would make. Peter, it is a much more substantive challenge. Peter is taking on the mayor stylistically, but substantively. Growth has been pushed too far, too fast. We need to slow it down. We don't need to do stadiums. It's a different challenge than Ed's presenting.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Ed always wants to talk about leadership, you know, collaboration versus divisiveness. And, you know, and I know what my personal reaction to that is, which is to say, okay, but what are you going to do? What are your specific issues? I don't know if how a normal person, as opposed to a political wonk, would react to that. But, you know, as I mentioned in a post the other day, this race has had more candidate forums than any mayoral race in recent memory. And what's really interesting about those forums, and again, I think this is to Ed's disadvantage in wanting to talk about style, is that they're all about super hyper-specific issues. So like, you know, what are we going to do about Belltown? What are we going to do about labor? What are we going to do? I mean, I went to the International District Rotary Club yesterday, and there were a lot of people there. And I mean,
well, that's a good thing,
which is great. But, you know, but it's I think for a candidate like Ed, that is extremely tiresome because he just wants to talk kind of at a 10,000 foot level about, you know, about how he would be a better leader. He doesn't want to talk about what he would do about, you know, the parking rates, you know, in the ID.
I just want to give a heads up to listeners that next week, Weekday in the Conversation, are going to give you interviews with all 9 of the candidates, and they're going to run Monday through Wednesday. So you can check out what they have to say about more than one issue, because this will be our only opportunity. Then we'll post those online at KUOW.org.
Are you interviewing the elusive Doug McQuaid as well? You said not.
Yes, I am on Tuesday.
All right. I'd be interested to hear that.
Knut?
Well, one of the interesting contrasts, say, between Ed Murray and Peter Steinbrück would be on perhaps the approach to business. Ed Murray points out that he's downtown Seattle's senator, he's getting a lot of business community support. And one of the reasons that he thinks he would be good for the business climate, et cetera, is that he is predictable. That is a criticism of McGinn, who's been seen as kind of absent or in a contentious relationship with business interests. And also that the city government has – one criticism is that the city government departments have become more difficult for business to deal with or for developers and whatnot to deal with. So that I think, is an interesting way to pitch it. Whereas, you know, Peter Steinbrück, when he talks about business, he's talking about industrial jobs. He's talking about the sort of the blue collar meat and potatoes things, which is one of the objections to the location of SoDo. And he talks about the neighborhoods, and it sets up the classic sort of downtown versus the neighborhoods split that has really been a long tradition in Seattle politics.
Hasn't McGinn, though, ultimately been very good for downtown businesses? It was a split 4 years ago where we had a downtown candidate, and that's not the person who won, and yet the person who became mayor has done a lot.
Well, I think, you know, I think if you were talking about small businesses in particular, and in addition to kind of the port and the marine businesses and industrial, I think Peter actually has an advantage because he can say, you know, oh, the mayor, you know, raised parking rates and that's destroying downtown. And, you know, he took away all these, you know, he's making congestion horrible by putting in bike lanes. And I mean, I'm not saying these are things that Peter is saying.
But
exactly. But he has actually talked about parking rates, as have a lot of the candidates. So I think, you know, when you're talking about small businesses, I'm not sure that McGinn does have an advantage there.
He's still suffering from the legacy of the tunnel fight, McGinn, which was definitely something the business community wanted, the establishment, if you will, the chamber type. So they never got over that. There have been things like the head tax, which has been repealed, but McGinn did want it, that some businesses didn't like. I think they probably didn't like his extreme push on the recent South Lake Union fight for more affordable housing, you know, extract more out of developers down there, even though he's given them a lot of height.
So, I was going to say, they got quite a bit out of that fight.
Yeah. So he does have some developer support, absolutely, McGinn.
Hmm. And I mean, the council ended up coming back and making it and saying, you know, even Mike O'Brien, his ally, saying this isn't enough, which is
affordable housing.
For affordable housing. Yeah. So the chamber has endorsed Ed Murray.
Just in thinking about this, I guess obviously I'm not a political creature because I can't imagine wanting this job. The learning curve has been 4 years or just about 4 years. And even so, there are things I think that McGinn is just beginning to figure out. And there's a lot of things that they end up talking about that they have no control over. Education is one, and probably the biggest. A, what is the job? And B, why does anybody want it?
Yeah, well, I wrote an article about, you know, you sure you want to be mayor was a piece I wrote this week. And I was having fun with the topic. And part of it is, how much time is spent putting on a funny hat during Seafood Week? Or, we found a great photo of Royer and Norm Rice, you know, both cutting the same ribbon, you know. I think there's a way in which the job is a really difficult one. It's certainly politically not rewarding beyond whatever you accomplish in the job itself. And I think we've talked about this before. The last mayor of Seattle to go on to a higher elective office, Art Langley, 1940. That's, you know, over 70 years of futility. And it's not because they haven't tried. Ullman, Rice, Royer, Nichols all have tried to do that. So it tends to be the end of your political, at least elective wise, it tends to be. And it is difficult because one is the whole Seattle process thing, which can be very, sluggish, lead to mediocrity. And the, you know, the other part of it is there are major things that are just out of your control. And the school, it's interesting you bring up the school thing. One of the things Ed Murray was talking about was to, you know, some ideas to try and draw more coordination between the school district and the city in terms of even just taking small pieces of it, like having the city demographer. Instead of having the school district and the city each having their own demographer, why not have, you know, the city do the demographic work for the school district as well as the city so that you could begin to integrate concepts like where dense housing goes and neighborhood schools, which now are completely uncoordinated. I mean, it's not just it's not solely a matter of the quality of the schools. And that's, of course, really critical.
I saw a program recently on Channel 9 with the five former mayors from Wes Ullman to Nichols. And despite all this sense that this is the worst job ever, they all said it was the best job they had ever had. They loved it. And, you know, perhaps it's easier to say that in reflection than when you're in the middle of it. But, you know, there are a lot of things you can do. School's pretty much out of your control. But, I mean, you know, you can do crime safety initiatives and help clean up a neighborhood. You can do important zoning changes, which, you know, maybe add accessory dwelling units or maybe improve a neighborhood. You can do parks. You can do community centers. You can promote human services. I mean, there's a ton of stuff you can do in this job that's very rewarding. But it comes, you know, at a price.
And you write the budget, and, you know, and you can have, you know, you can do things like have a vision for the waterfront that you've been in, and the transit master plan. And to go to the funny hats issue, I mean, I think, you know, I think people who seek this job love that part of it.
The funny hat?
I mean, I don't understand that either, but it's not, I wouldn't seek that job. I don't want to meet, you know, 100 people a day, but
although you probably do,
although I probably do, but I think people who are drawn to that kind of job are the kind of people who throw salmon bakes and shrimp boils and, you know, love glad handing.
Well, you better love it, because it won't the citizens won't pay you back. You know, if you look at the history of the mayorship in Seattle, we throw people out, we recall them, we don't reward them with higher office. So you better get whatever you want to get done in that term.
So since, although I haven't heard CR say he's not going to run for mayor ever, but I'm sure at this point Eric is not. But if you were running for mayor and I told you, you know, give me your top priority, what would your top priority this year be, Erica?
I've never been asked that question. Probably implementing a smart transit plan for the city.
CR?
I can definitively say I will never run for mayor of Seattle.
All right, good.
Just to get that out.
All right, but now what's your top campaign plank?
I do think this year that transportation and transit funding is huge. And I do also think public safety. I mean, if I were running for mayor, I certainly would be talking about those two themes.
And Knut, your mayoral platform.
What would
your top plank? Oh. A fish in every pot.
I just don't think that way. I'd be a terrible mayor, and I wouldn't ever run.
All right, don't vote for Knut.
I'm sitting in Joni's chair over here, so I can give you her platform.
Okay.
32 more police officers next year.
Next year. We are talking over the week's news and mulling about the Seattle mayoral primary with Erica C. Barnett, C.R. Douglas, Knut Berger. We'll have more on a different subject when we come back on Weekday.
And 40, 59 degrees in Seattle. It's still mostly cloudy, but the forecast says it's going to be at least partly sunny this afternoon with a high today of 71.
I'm Bob Garfield, and on this week's On the Media, if the U.S. government refuses to call Egypt's coup a coup, what word should the media stand by? How about courage?
The government often doesn't want to call things what they are. It's the job of the media to be honest about those things and to call out the government when it's equivocating for its own reasons.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Sunday evening at 6 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and Green Stage present the 13th Annual Seattle Outdoor Theater Festival, July 13th and 14th at Volunteer Park. 2 days, 8 local theater companies, and 15 different performances of outdoor theater. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
1041, I'm Bernard Ouellette. A Boeing Dreamliner caught fire at Britain's Heathrow Airport. We're going to hear a report from NPR in the news at 11.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. We're talking over the week's news with Knut Berger, C.R. Douglas, Erica C. Barnett, and journalism news. Just briefly, David Boardman used Facebook to announce that he was leaving the Seattle Times to become the dean of the School of Media and Communication at Temple University in Philadelphia. He'd been asked, I don't know, 6 months ago whether he was going to take the dean's job at the Annenberg School, and he said no. But I guess at Philadelphia is more tempting.
Who knows what's in the man's heart? I mean, it's obviously a devastating, it's devastating for the Seattle Times. On the other hand, their editorial board has been taking some kind of interesting turns lately. And I think, they're becoming younger. They're becoming a little bit more liberal, dare I say, for the Seattle Times. So I think they're moving in a different direction, in general. So, I don't know that it's, a crushing blow, but it will be very interesting to see what they do, in choosing a successor or successors to him.
It's our one major daily newspaper anymore. He's overseen the sort of, not by choice, but the massive decimation of the editorial staff. I think I read 45% cut in reporters.
Yeah, that was an industry that was been hugely hit in the recession. It continues to struggle because of, all the online stuff. And he, from all reports, did an amazing job of leading the Times through that transition. Has had a pretty amazing three-decade career there. All the reports from this guy are positive. I had met him a couple times. Of course, never worked for him, but wish I had, because he sounds like he was a great mentor. The Times is going to struggle with this sort of relic of print in a world that's moving digital. It's sort of like Microsoft, we talked about earlier, kind of mm-hmm. stuck in a PC-based world. So he was sort of overseeing that transition. They are still the preeminent print news source in town, and probably the preeminent or close to digital source. They won 4 Pulitzers under his leadership. He was a great guy.
There were a couple of kind of questionable decisions under his leadership, or at least in recent days, probably more than a couple, as we could say, any of ourselves too. But the two I'm thinking of are giving away the free ads in the last election cycle to Rob McKenna and the gay marriage campaign, mm-hmm. And in their digital services going to a paywall model, which I have no idea how that's working out. Maybe their readers don't know how to get around it. Maybe they are making money. I personally, when I see, an AP story that I can get anywhere behind a paywall, I sort of look at that and say, okay, that is an industry that is in decline. If they don't understand their readership, does not want to pay 99 cents a week or whatever it ultimately costs, I think that's their introductory rate.
Is that it?
I would never would pay for a daily newspaper online.
I have to say I pay for it in paper. It comes to my house still. But Knut, come from the newspapering world.
Yes. One thing I'll say, Dave Boardman, I don't think had anything to do with giving away the ads. So, that was a decision. But he was effective both at putting out a good newspaper and dealing with the owner, Frank Blethyn, who is a handful, I think, I think part of the thing that Boardman accomplished that is so impressive to me, having been an editor of Seattle Weekly, editor of a newspaper in good times and also in hard times, trying to improve a product while laying people off is an incredibly difficult thing to do. And the fact that, not only were they able to win Pulitzer Prizes, but they have not yielded in a commitment to news coverage. They can't do it all. They don't have the resources, and they've lost the advantage of some of the competition they used to have, which I think probably did make for better newspapering when you had two newspapers trying to outdo each other. And there's always been this from the standpoint of having been an editor of a newspaper that competed with the Times. Now, my thought always was the more newspapers, the better. And, the daily newspapers, make the job of doing a weekly newspaper easier because there's so much reporting that they're doing that you can't possibly do. From a business standpoint, the Times was always a very rapacious competitor. They always viewed everybody, no matter how big or small, a competitor and treated them, I think, fairly shabbily. Dave Boardman did not bring that attitude to the editorial side in terms of he was always the guy you could talk to at the other paper. You know, he takes the phone calls. And I think he just had tremendous respect. And I think in this era, when daily newspapers themselves, even in one newspaper towns, it apparently you're not guaranteed a seat anymore. We've got the Times Picayune and other newspapers that are now cutting back to 2 or 3 days a week or basically, going online only. I think he will make it harder for the Times to continue the thing that they really – the value that they really bring, which is that original reporting that's at a very high level. And hopefully he mentored enough people that, that'll continue.
I wonder what kind of onus that puts on especially Erica and you, not you necessarily, Knut, but Crosscut, folks who are at startup online places. Like, do you feel this need to fill a gap or do you go into a different direction totally?
Well, I feel that we fill a gap that is breaking news. I mean, I think there is a breaking news gap. I think one thing that is very difficult for online publications to do is the kind of research something for 6 months and do nothing else kind of reporting that we used to see. And I am just like, when I see one of those stories, I'm like, oh yeah, that exists. Because, when you're online, I mean, it's, people get mad if you don't have a news story out every 10 minutes. And so I think, we have a responsibility to be, to be breaking news that other publications aren't, and to be, as scrupulously accurate as, a daily newspaper, and to correct ourselves when we're wrong. And, I think that is something that's not an ethos that's always been around in online publications. And, I come from a newspaper background as well. And, and that's kind of what we try to bring to it. But as far as those, 6 month, on assignment stories, I mean, that is very much a product of the daily newspaper and magazine world.
Marcy, I've been doing a lot of historical research this summer, and so I've been literally, my head has been buried in the Seattle Times, the PI, the Argus, the Seattle Star. We used to have four daily newspapers, but for a while we had three. And I'll tell you that the Seattle of 1903 was much better covered. People were much better informed. The news holes and news staffs and the different personalities of the paper. You had establishment paper, you had this the kind of tabloid paper, and then you had the lefty paper. There, with all the transformation to the web, with all of television and radio and electronics, the basic journalism being done is so much less than it used to be, and just in terms of volume and commitment. And so I think that, it's really, I think Publicola and Crosscut and other, we're playing a really important role, but I think we're just tiny pieces of what is a big unmet need.
And so, CR, what you're an analyst, not a boots-on-the-ground reporter on a daily basis, but what is the role of TV news, which is much maligned in many quarters?
Yeah, and we see our competitors not necessarily as Seattle Times, but as, King Cairo Como.
Right.
I mean, those are who are our sites. That's who we see when we look at the ratings every morning from the overnights. TV news is for those who, want it quick, want it sort of fed to them, want it in, minute or 2 minute, increments. A lot of people don't get newspapers, don't read Publicola. but are, you know, getting stuff on TV. So there's still an audience out there for it. We still have, you know, big numbers, especially if we've got a big lead in, you know. And we're trying to do our role in informing the community of the important things too.
You come to commercial TV from a long career in
non-commercial TV.
Yeah, very non-commercial TV. I don't know how many years you worked at Seattle Channel, but numerous years.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that changes the focus or what you're able to do.
Well, at the Seattle Channel, of course, we were non-commercial, so we're not daily worried about ratings. We're not selling any ad time. So, you know, we could do sort of longer format things. I was certainly doing a longer format show weekly, where we didn't, you know, at the end of the day, we didn't have to worry about how large our audience was. It's a different animal at commercial television station. You know, you are based on ratings. You know, your ads are going to sell based on how many people watch you. So it's, you know, the downside of that is that you're playing to your audience a little bit more, if you will. But, you know, from coming from the Seattle Channel, where I could do a lot of long format stuff, but I tell you, the amount of people that are seeing and hearing a Fox broadcast or just an evening newscast on any of the stations is just exponentially greater than ever saw me or heard me or listened to the Seattle Channel.
Where do you get your news?
Well, I mean, I now by all these stations, I mean, we've got every single station up on the TV wall. So I'm seeing King, Cairo, Como. But I'm reading Canute. I'm reading Erica. I'm reading The Weekly. I'm reading The Stranger. You know, I mean, I'm reading all the print online sources as well.
So I know Josh and Erica have no time to read anything because I believe they work 20 hours a day, or at least that's what it seems like. So, but seriously, where are you looking beyond?
I literally hundreds of blogs. So I read all the same things. I mean, The Stranger, the Weekly to some extent. But, you know, there's tons of online sources. There's neighborhood blogs that, you know, are of varying quality. But that's a lot of where I get my news. East Side News, I was going to say when Knut was talking about how much more coverage there used to be. I mean, there is almost, it is so difficult to find any coverage of the East Side. So there's a couple of little online publications that give me sort of a hint of what's going on over there. But that is another big, big gap.
I miss still the Bellevue Journal-American. And how long has it been since that paper folded?
Well, I can't remember exactly when it folded, but in the 2000s. I mean, it was fairly recently. The East Side, that is amazing because I was a part of I actually wrote a column for the old Bellevue Journal-American, but also was editor of East Side
Week. Right.
And it's funny to think, I mean, in the mid-1990s, the East Side had a huge Seattle Times bureau. Seattle Times threw an enormous number of reporters and had them resident on the East Side doing a lot of really great
reporting. There was a whole section.
Right.
Yeah, there was a whole East Side section. At one point, Frank Blethyn even threatened to move the Seattle Times to the East Side in a fit of pique. And the printing plant was over there. But so you had this great coverage from the Times. You had the Journal-American, plus you had the South County Journal.
Right.
And both each paper had dedicated reporters at King County. So you had Danny Westneat and Ed Hegstrom and various very good reporters at these things. And then you had, a good weekly newspaper over there. Now there's absolutely nothing. I have to say Crosscut would love to do more coverage on the East Side. That's something we're, hoping to do and looking into. I've done a little reporting over there recently, and we would love to do more. It's really terrible.
So when aspiring, glowing-eyed college students come to you and say they want to be journalists, what do you say? I know you guys take interns at Publicola.
We do.
You must see some of those glowy aspiring journalists.
Yeah, I mean, and I am shocked that people are still aspiring journalists. And this is something I would love to talk to David Boardman about, who's going to lead a journalism department. But I mean, you know, we just say you're going to have to work for nothing. And it's a different system now. I mean, when I was starting out in journalism, you know, it was, you're going to have to move to some horrible place and work for a tiny paper and work your way up. And now it's, you know, you're going to have five internships and, you know, and you're going to have to learn HTML and you're going to have to learn to do really quick turnaround and to, you know, check. But there's still jobs in journalism. It's just, you know, there are fewer and they, you know, they probably, well, journalism is never paid well. So anybody who's an aspiring journalist, you know, doesn't want to make money in the first place or isn't very smart.
So, CR, your words of wisdom?
Well, we take a lot of interns at Q13 Fox. One thing that's different now, and I'm an example of it, is that if you wanted to come to Seattle and be a reporter and analyst, you know, we're the 12th largest TV market in the world, in the country. So you don't just start here. I mean, you sort of work up. People are in Medford, and then they might be in Portland, and, you know, then they're, you know, it's kind of a destination. You know, some people have certainly moved on from here to New York and LA and bigger markets, but for a lot of people, this is a destination. They get to Seattle and they are excited and they retire here. So I didn't go to Cheyenne. I didn't go to Medford. I didn't go to Salem.
You worked for free.
Well, I was getting paid at the Seattle Channel, but I actually started in public access. But right. I sort of worked up through the culture of all this alternative TV within this market. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did the smaller jobs, but I did them in Seattle. And I would say to someone now coming up in TV, that's possible because of things like the Seattle Channel, TVW, King County TV, the Seattle School District. I mean, there are all these kind of alternative, you know, ways you could build a career here without going to another market and then landing in Seattle.
So those are the TV equivalents of neighborhood blogs.
Absolutely.
Okay, Knut, last word.
I would just say Crosscut has some really great interns, and it's really heartening to see the quality of young people who still want to get into the business. I think CR's right. They have to be really adaptive and creative in order to find niches for themselves. I wish it were as easy as having a big, robust industry that could just hire the best and brightest, you know, when you found them. It's not that way right now. But I have confidence that the new business models will emerge that will make that possible, because I think the need is there. It's just we're still all struggling to figure out how to make the jump.
Okay, hear that, aspiring journalists. And also good luck to David Boardman on your next venture. And be sure you tell that to all those kids with the glowy eyes who want to crack the next Watergate. Our guests have been Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News, and Erica C. Barnett, who's editor at Publicola, getting the news so that we have it. Thanks, all three of you.
Thank you.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette, the man at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Next week, 9 mayoral candidates cross through the doors of KUOW to bring you information that you can use when you mark your ballots. This is KUOW.
Several people have been killed in a train crash south of Paris. More about that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Guillermo del Toro grew up in Mexico, obsessed with Japanese monster movies.
The way they transported me, the way they made me feel in awe, it's unlike any Western movie genre ever.
And now he's created his own version with the new film Pacific Rim, movie monsters and their meaning, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 7 p.m. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
This is a test, only a test, of the emergency.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.